key to life.
Hello, this is Sekou Burmese, your host of The Lit Review, a podcast brought to you by the Academy of Management Journal. In this podcast, we dive into the insights of recent research published in the journal and interview authors and corporate leaders to discuss the inspiration for research ideas and how insights from this research apply to current pressing needs in organizations and markets. In this episode, I speak with David Lucas, a professor at the Whitman School of Management at Syracuse University. In our conversation, we talk about a recent paper David has published at AMJ about remaking capitalism into a more just, sustainable, and inclusive system. The paper explores how legislation can shape how intensely firms focus on values-driven business. This leads to a broader discussion about the purpose of the modern firm, and also we get into the sometimes paradoxical way that policies and laws can get firms to shift away from a narrow focus on shareholder maximization. I hope that you enjoy this episode of The Lit Review and my discussion with David Lucas. My guest on The Lit Review podcast is David Lucas, the Edward Patanella Assistant Professor of Entrepreneurship in the Whitman School of Management at Syracuse University, as well as being a research fellow with the Institute for an Entrepreneurial Society. His research focuses on the intersection of entrepreneurship, organizations, and public policy, with an emphasis on grand societal challenges. He has written several award-winning articles on this topic and has even testified before Congress about his research, so he should have no problem dealing with my questions. Hello, David, and welcome to the Lit Review podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, pleasure to have you on. Really, really enjoyed reading the paper that's going to be the focus of this pod. And so, why don't we dive right in? And so, this is a paper that you published with Matthew Grimes and Joel Gaiman entitled Remaking Capitalism, The Strength of Weak Legislation in Mobilizing B Corporation Certification. So that is a mouthful. We are going to break it down and dissect what that means exactly. But my lay reading of this is the primary question that you pose in the paper is to understand how the passing of sustainability legislation affects the adoption of values-driven objectives. But before we get into the papers, I just want to ask kind of a general question about your motivations. What got you interested on this topic about capitalism and its remaking, so to speak?
Sure. Well, thank you again for the opportunity to be here and to talk to you about this. My journey into this topic is, I think, maybe atypical. My sense is that many of the voices in the conversation around remaking capitalism come at it from the starting point that this is a broken thing and either the cause of, or at least partly responsible for, most of the things that are wrong in the world. And in that sense, the goal of the remaking is to move away from some of the key principles of ownership and exchange and maybe move toward the state increased direction of economic activity. But I actually kind of tend to come from the opposite starting point. I think that societies that have celebrated ownership through the protection of property rights and emphasized organizing to engage in voluntary exchange through price systems, that those are the ones that have effectively allocated scarce resources to not just create billionaires, but also to yield massive reductions in extreme poverty and increase human flourishing. So that's kind of my starting point, which is a little different from maybe others in this, but I can hopefully walk and chew gum at the same time and recognize that there's many things that we see in our current manifestations of this, which are not just an ideal type, but a real world, where we've seen cronyism, reductions in competition, growing concerns about technological change that suggests maybe we need to rethink what the use of knowledge and the creation of incentives for organizations, how they're governed. And that comes from public sources, but also private sector as well.
All right. So you are on the side of capitalism. You love capitalism, I would say. You love it so much that you want to remake it to make it better.
I believe that every system is flawed and that people are also flawed. And so finding ways to make us better versions of ourselves, that's often an incentives question.
Yeah. All right. Well, you said incentives twice. So I guess the cat's out of the bag. You are an economist. You are trained as an economist because you love incentives. We'll get to this later. I did not guess you to be a trained economist based on kind of the topics here. but I'm really fascinated. And your intro kind of explains that, yeah, okay, every system is flawed. Let's figure out ways to make it better, which I really appreciate. And I agree with you. I think it is somewhat unorthodox that a lot of people looking at these grand challenges don't start from the same place, but I think you end in the same place. So with that said, let's dive into the central phenomenon. And I'm going to ask you to help us out here, because this is a paper that I admittedly had to read and then reread the intro to make sure I understood it. And there's a bit of a nuance here to this that I think is really useful and valuable. So could you quickly define for us the top pieces of your paper around benefit corporation legislation? That's one thing. Yep. And B corporation certification. And that's another thing. That's a different thing.
Absolutely. And that is confusing. It's a fantastic question. You're not the only one who's confused by that. You see it in the media all the time. Policymakers who are passing laws about this are using them interchangeably, and they're not the same. And even in academic papers about this, which is maybe the funniest one, because hopefully we have a responsibility to start to get this right if we're talking about it. So there's these two levers or sources of governance for organizations that we look at in the paper. B corporations, the B corporation certification is this voluntary third-party certification that organizations can attain that is offered by a nonprofit called B Lab. So B Lab provides the B corporation certification. And in order to get certified as a B Corp, these companies must complete a fairly rigorous assessment, and it looks to quantify numerically the impact of the organization on a variety of stakeholders, areas like customers or workers, the community, environment, governance practices. And you have to get a certain amount of points to even qualify, and then you have to pay on a sliding scale to be certified. But if you are, you can have this certification. There's now 8,000 certified B Corps worldwide, and if you go to the grocery store or retailers these days, a lot of customer-facing products have that circle with a B inside on it somewhere in the corner now, especially at end user kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's the B Corp.
So that's the B Corp, B Corporation certification. All right. Now what's this other thing?
Yeah. So the benefit corporation legislation, this is a corporate structure. It's a legal form that many states in the U.S. and some other countries have passed. So much like you could think about an LLC or the C Corp legal form. So this is intendedly an alternative corporate structure that builds on those existing for-profit regimes, but adds some additional requirements about the reporting of your impact and any public benefits that you're trying to produce, and several different stipulations alongside of that.
And how widespread is this legislation in the U.S.?
So when we wrote the paper, I believe it was 36 states. Maryland, my home state where I grew up, was the first in 2010. And now I believe it's over 40 states that have passed this. So there are thousands and thousands of companies that have either adopted or been incorporated initially as benefit corporations.
All right. So it's widespread in the U.S. You've now talked about these two different things. So one is a legal form. That's the benefit corporation legislate based on this legislation. And are these given a name? Are they called something?
They're called benefit corporations.
They're called benefit corporations. Yeah. And then the B Corp certification, these are called
B Corps.
B Corps and benefit corporations. All right. So you can see why it's confusing.
And here's what's really interesting about that confusion. So B Lab, the nonprofit, they actually described it, one of the co-founders described it to a group of researchers as a bit intentional expressly. Mm. And we quote this in the paper. So their view was that the certification alone wasn't going to cut it and that the legislation alone wasn't going to cut it. They wanted them to all feel like they were part of the same movement. Mm. And B Lab played a major role in pushing for the benefit corporation legislation. They wrote model legislation. They helped mobilize grassroots in the states. So they've had a hand. And in fact, it's their theory of change that these two things will yield positive synergies to one another. And that's what we try to go after in this paper.
All right. And so I love this. So this is good because it's leading right into kind of what you believe are some of the key findings here for the paper. And so could you kind of lay out what the paper is talking about? Because this idea of the confusion, the purposeful confusion of these two, I find to be really interesting. But can you set the paper up and maybe talk about what you think the key findings are?
Absolutely. So this nonprofit B-Lab, that they have this systems view of how to help move the norms toward using business as a force for good in society. And that involved pushing for this legislation and the certification. Their view was that these things were going to work well together. And in some ways, that was the motivation for the start of our research question. How does the passage of this benefit corporation legislation affect the uptake, adoption, and retention of the B Corp certification? So thinking about interdependence in a kind of systems-oriented way. The short answer of the finding is that when the law gets passed and you have this benefit corporation legislation, you get more firms becoming certified B Corps, so they're adopting the private certification more, and the ones that are certified are more likely to retain it. Mm-hmm. So on the surface, the high-level finding is, it sounds like B-Lab is brilliant, it's exactly what they expected, but it's a little bit trickier than that when we really tried to theorize and explain the mechanisms through which this was happening. And to understand that, you have to recognize that in the legal scholarship on benefit corporations and this legislation around them, law scholars almost unanimously agree that these laws are incredibly weak. They're vague, they're toothless, there's almost no enforcement. So for example, one of the few requirements is an annual benefit report that you have to just publish on your website or maybe send to the state. Legal scholars have looked up what share of benefit corporations are doing this. 10%, 0% in lots of cases, almost no compliance with this minimal disclosure. So the sense is that the law is not really driving some kind of strong change. It's actually relatively weak. And so then how could there be this win-win? What's going on? We were able to actually show that it's because of the law's weakness and the ability that it creates for there to be benefit corporations that have these unverified claims, mm-hmm. that then truly authentic, sustainable businesses wanted to demonstrate this and kind of separate themselves via the more rigorous certification. So the private sector in this case was the source of rigor, whereas the public sector was a source of weak oversight, which is not usually what we see or think about.
All right. Let me see if I can unpack this. So the more rigorous one is the B Corp certification. And yes, these are companies that you can feel pretty confident are not only pursuing the benefits for the owners, but also for society in some tangible way, right? So this is kind of purpose-driven kind of organizations.
Yes.
Now, there's also this legislation that allows you to become a benefit corporation that is toothless, that is kind of like, hey, you do it, but what does it mean? Do you actually have to follow the rules? It's kind of when it could be thought of as window dressing. At least that's what legal scholars think about it.
Yes.
But the benefit or the positive outcome of passing this weak legislation, as you put it, is that it actually does drive more companies to do the more rigorous thing. Right. And so while so this is kind of thinking about what is the upside to weak legislation. Is that a key? Is that a good synopsis of the takeaway?
Beautiful. I wish we had you as a co-author to help state it so clearly.
That's right. Well, I'm doing it now. So this would be great for the follow up. Talk to Joel and Matthew. Add me on there. So this is good. Were there any unexpected findings? Right. So that, to me, is somewhat paradoxical. And I always wonder, did you go into this thinking this would be the case, or was this something that you discovered? And so can you give us some behind the scenes, anything that was surprising that maybe even wasn't in the paper?
Yeah, great question. Well, initially, when we started to think about this legislation, we had B-Lab's story in mind. But quickly, as we started to read up on this, the sense was that it was a weak form of law, and we became very skeptical that it was going to yield benefits in terms of the certification. So that was surprising. We were pushed and encouraged throughout the review process to really build out and test the mechanisms of the strength of the law. So we ended up coding different legislation across the states for two different forms, one of which had very clearly as weak as could be, and the other was B-Lab's preferred model that was a little bit stronger of the law. They said, this is how you should do it. And the ones that deviated and took the bare minimum, that was driving the effect of this initial certification. So that was surprising, I think, in the process. And one other thing that was unexpected for me, just in the research process itself, was how great it can be to work with scholars of different intellectual backgrounds. So Matthew and Joel, my co-authors, are both brilliant and extremely kind. They come from sort of not economics, where I was trained. And in some ways, it was sort of like a second degree for me, or maybe learning how to speak a different language, something like that. But we came together in, I think, a really productive way, and were able to draw on different disciplines in our theorizing and try to engage societal conversation around this topic.
That's great to hear. I mean, working, and we talk about interdisciplinary work, can be really useful and valuable. And so, but it's difficult to publish is usually the issue. And so I'm very glad that you guys stuck through this, and that that you actually published it, and that you were surprised at your own findings, which is always nice. All right, so I want to expand out from the paper a bit, and particularly around this, the paradox of the strength of weak legislation, right? As I don't know if you coined that term, but if you didn't, you should. That this toothless legislation actually led to private interests to do the more rigorous work. And I was just wondering to what extent you think this is generalizable, right? So you study grand challenges, and sustainability is one of them, but there are many others, right? Poverty and inequality and health. And so I was wondering, because legislation around all these things is always constantly in the news. And to what extent do you think this idea of the strength of weak legislation might actually be applicable there?
Great question. I think it's widely applicable. On the one hand, in this context, the kinds of businesses that are engaging this are doing all different forms of social impact, whether it's related to the environment, employees' rights, human suffering. But even beyond this specific context of the B Corps benefit corporations, et cetera, I tend to see policy when it's most effective at helping organizations and individuals to engage with each other in positive ways. It's usually enabling rather than mandating, in terms of, especially since moral values are so contested ideologically and otherwise in our culture, putting organizations in the driver's seat, and then in that way, putting customers in the driver's seat to decide what values are really important. So as two small examples of this. One is that Joel Gaiman and I have sort of follow-up work thinking about other legal dimensions, especially targeting like social ventures, especially those that are nonprofit moving into the market side. And one of the policy things that has been adopted in many countries is trying to introduce limited profit distributions. So this is a strong rule that says you can only distribute up to a certain X percent of your profits to your shareholders. And that way we balance this tightrope of social and economic goals. And our work seems to be suggesting that that actually yields negative unintended consequences for the organization, because it's this strong rule. You can exactly this much, and that's just the right amount, trying to find some Goldilocks mandate rather than maybe trying to enable ways for organizations to demonstrate and prove their impact and their balance of those things. That's one example.
So what I love about this is that it is, you're putting a lot of faith in the market and in organizations, right? That if given a basic guideline, or if given at least an opportunity to do better, to do more, right, to benefit society, that they will take that on and kind of carry it forward, as opposed to the view that, well, unless you kind of force them, organizations are going to kind of do what benefits themselves and not others, right? And so do you think that that's a baked-in kind of assumption into your worldview, or do you think that's something that you gained from the research?
Great question. I might restate it slightly. Rather than putting a lot of faith in organizations, I'd try to put comparable faith across all the different ways that we could try to govern action. And so people often say, well, oh, government has to come in and make them be good, but then why would we put faith in humans in one context versus humans in another? It's usually a function of knowledge, what resources they have to know what the right things to do, and then the incentives to do it. And that's the economist in me coming out there. But so my worldview is informed by economics and by my Christian faith, and those two things together try to take a balanced view and then say which of these structures is going to best enable us to engage. And so is it faith in organizations? Not particularly. They could still get it wrong. But maybe it's skepticism that is imposed on all parties across sectors.
Healthy skepticism that is equally distributed, public and privately. And I think I kind of like that because it's in a lot of the discussions that you see about, you know, the public-private and government intervention, non-government intervention, there's usually some demonizing of the other side. And I think what you're saying is they're both people, they're both fallible, but they're both trying to do what's right for the organization, which should be in the best interests of society. And so maybe allow the space for that to happen might be useful. That's good. So a healthy dose of skepticism with some faith. I like it. So last but not least, you mentioned, and I've already alluded to this fact, you were trained as an economist. And I found that really interesting because, again, due to the nature of a lot of your work, which is, you know, really impressive, but really focused on how we can rethink the purpose of organizations, right? And, you know, the field of economics and large, a lot of people within, you know, my field have adopted this kind of shareholder maximization view as what should be, you know, and this is a little normative, what should be the purpose of an organization. And a lot of what you're talking about in this paper is, you know, the idea of a B Corp or a benefit corporation is that the purpose is not just shareholder maximization, it's some other things. And so what do you think about kind of that current dialogue around the purpose of the modern firm?
I think that for all of the value that the shareholder maximization view has added, and it's added quite a lot, it's sort of been presented as an amoral, non-moral side of the argument. And I think that's a losing way to present the case, in part because organizing doesn't happen in a vacuum, nor does capitalism. And that means that there are human beings in a political, social, and economic structure all at the same time. You know, when Milton Friedman wrote about the social responsibility of the firm, one of the fascinating things that is often overlooked is that, yes, the primary obligation is to shareholders to maximize these profits, but there was this little phrase tagged on, within the rules of the game. And that's really interesting because in many cases, increasingly, we're seeing that the rules of the game, the policy that what denotes, quote unquote, fair competition or what should be done is actually endogenous to the interests of organizations, meaning they can influence the policy. So if you're trying to maximize profit with respect to constraints that you can control, where does that place you? So at minimum, at best, it places the government in the position of the moral arbiter, whatever the rules are that are legal or that pays to break the rule, maybe in a rational sort of corporate crime framework or whatever you want to say. We're basically saying, okay, then the state becomes the determinant of whether or not we should or should not do things, even though they're acting like it's the market. And so really there should be a moral foundation for action that informs how we go about this. And I think that some of these forms, these new corporate structures or certifications may enable that in a way that still brings out the best of what ownership and exchange and markets can offer.
The role of morality in talking about kind of business and strategy is definitely something I find myself talking about more and more, particularly in my classrooms. Yeah. When I'm talking about topics with my students, and we're talking around and around, and I was like, well, I think at the root of this is, what do you think is right in some way? And if we agree on that, then I think the rest of it follows. But if we disagree on that, then that's really where we need to have the discussion, and that usually gets us to the point. So do you feel that there is maybe room for more discussions about morality in thinking about the purpose of firms and legislation and the like?
Absolutely. And I think if we act like there is no moral underpinning of our position, then we will vilify the other side with acting like we are not doing so. Mm-hmm. But you see it everywhere with the discourse presenting one side as good and one side as evil, but not particularly engaging what are the values that we're trying to go after, which of those are common, and then how do the means that we're trying to pursue those things yield these ends, or do they go a different direction? And often it's that disconnect that could be analytically assessed more carefully in our debates and our discussion rather than the moral values themselves, how to get there.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, I look forward to you resolving all of these questions, you and Joel, in your next couple of papers. It's great. I think the Nobel Committee is looking forward to reading all those things. All right. Before we go, two questions that I like to ask all my guests. The first is, recognizing that a lot of our research is driven by phenomena that we see out in the world that we don't understand or we struggle to comprehend. And oftentimes that is the inspiration for research. And so is there anything kind of happening right now that really piques your curiosity? Any sorts of events or patterns or behaviors that really make you say, like, what's going on there?
Yeah, one of the challenges I've thought a lot about since my dissertation work is the issue of homelessness. And we're seeing that come to a head in many urban centers and otherwise very wealthy countries like the United States and elsewhere. Yep. But what's exciting to me in relation to that are increasing attention drawn to these potential technological breakthroughs that could really transform housing markets, things like 3D printed homes, which has started to happen in the US, or modular processes where they're trying to produce at scale and reduce the cost of housing. Homelessness is much more than a housing problem for many individuals experiencing it. But that topic and its urgency stands, I think, for many people in stark contrast to the gains in wealth that capitalism has produced. And so that's an area where my heart is drawn very particularly.
Yeah, and I watched a video of you talking about these things in Congress. So you were very well passionately spoken then, and it doesn't surprise me that continues to be something that you think through. All right, last thing, fun question. We've been talking about such fun topics like morality and sustainability and homelessness. Let's end on a light note. What are you reading for fun right now?
I'm trying to get tenure, so nothing. No, I'm just kidding. I have, and I also have two small kids and one on the way. So actually my wife and I have been reading a book by Andy Crouch called The Tech Wise Family. And we're trying to, it's not so fun, but it's fun in the sense to think about how we want to teach our children how to engage with the world that we're living in today.
The Tech Wise Parents. All right.
Yeah, tech Wise Family.
Family. Okay. And so this is engaging with tech in a smart way. I just choose to let the tech companies tell me what's right.
Most of us do.
Like they have my best interest at heart. I mean,
when
have they ever done me wrong? anything else you're reading for fun? Do you read any fiction? Now, again, you are trying to get tenure, so I get it. But do you read any fiction, any biographies, anything like that?
Yeah, Dostoevsky, like Brothers Karamazov recently. It's really
so awesome light reading, one. Just light, easy.
Yeah, it's good for when you're laying floor in a basement, you know, it's good listening. So,
all right, well, I appreciate that you learn about tech and what it's like to be poor and Russian in the 18th century. And I feel like those aren't too different if you think about it. So, thank you very much, David, for your time, for walking us through this really, I think, very fascinating, interesting, and impactful paper. I love these questions, and I think, you know, they're called grand challenges for a reason. It's because it's going to take a lot of work from a lot of us. And I appreciate the work that you and your co-authors have done thus far. So thanks for your time and take it easy.
Thank you so much.
All right. That's it for the Lit Review. I appreciate David for his time and I appreciate you all for listening. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Lit Review podcast. You can find this podcast by searching The Lit Review, an AMJ podcast, on iTunes, Spotify, and other podcast platforms, as well as on the AMJ homepage. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we have a weekly Spaces show called AMJ Radio Live, hosted by @AOMConnect. Thanks to the Academy of Management for their support for this podcast. Special thanks to my producer, Holly Fearing, for all of her work behind the scenes. Our theme music is produced by Key to Life. This is Sekou Burmese. See you next time. Take care and be good.